The Mid-Century White House Conference on Children and Youth, Washington, D.C., December 3-7, 1950. Dr. Benjamin M. Spock, co-director of the Rochester Child Health Institute, Rochester, Minnesota, is a vice chairman of the National Committee of the Conference. His address to the delegates is on the subject, What We Know Today About the Development of Healthy Personality in Children and Youth. Dr. Spock.
At the meeting in September of the fact-finding committee and staff, after we'd gone over reports on the complexity of personality growth, on the influences of culture, on the many ways in which the social services can contribute to a troubled family, we came to a frightened realization. These reports make the development of a healthy personality sound so hazardous. American parents might well conclude that it's hopeless to try to acquire all the knowledge and to find all the facilities necessary to bring up children right. Such a conclusion would, of course, be fatally wrong. Solemnly, we agreed that the one thing that is vital is that a child have a pair of good parents who love him truly. With such a start, he can probably put up with some degree of poverty or other social disadvantage, because his parents stand between him and the world, interpreting it to him in the light of their own wholesomeness, and helping him to deal with it. He can probably make the best of mediocre schooling. He can probably get along without social services and come through with a personality that's capable of achieving individual happiness and responsible citizenship. Such a stable person will have a good chance of picking an excellent wife and of getting along splendidly with her without benefit of marriage counseling. When their children come along, these parents will probably be able to do a good job without the help of child study courses or psychiatrists. Then why do we have a White House conference? You know the reasons. A large percentage of our people are ineffectual or unhappy, and they make everyone else miserable. There's too much cruelty and hatred and suspicion and fear. There are too many mentally ill people. The number of marriages that end in divorce suggests a disturbing degree of immaturity in the supposedly adult years. There are too many criminals. When individual cases are studied carefully, we can usually find clear causes, most often beginning in childhood, which theoretically could have been prevented if the means had been available. What do we know today about the development of personality in children? I can only give examples. The baby is quite helpless for a good part of the first year. Yet to me, the most fascinating fact of infancy is that a baby a couple of months old, at a time when he can't talk, stand, sit, reach with his hand, or even hold his head steady, still knows how to smile and does so delightedly when his mother greets him. He's clearly intended to love and to evoke love from the beginning. Even stuffy people fall into baby talk with him. Is this just sentimental talk? No. It's a fact that infants who have long been starved for company and affection, for instance, in cold-hearted, understaffed institutions, may wither in body and spirit. They lose all joy in doing things and seeing people. At a year of age, they may spend their days lying sadly on their backs, rolling their heads from side to side. If the neglect lasts too long, the responsiveness to life may be impossible to resuscitate, and they may grow up apathetic, unloving people. Such tragedies are rare, but they prove that love is as vital as calories, and that the baby's personality is being shaped from the start by the mother's and father's attitudes. Erickson has said that in the first year of life, the baby acquires his basic sense of trust, trust in his parents' loving ministrations, and through that, trust in himself. In the period from perhaps 1 to 3 years, he gets his sense of autonomy. He learns to walk, and he never stops walking. He explores. He feels the shapes of things. He climbs. He shakes everything that isn't nailed down. He tastes paper, specks of dust, the dog's tail. He gradually goes longer distances from his mother. He's testing the world. He's testing and exercising his own skills. He's building self-confidence and independence. Secure parents take this new, this semi-autonomous child in their stride, sensing he's now requiring tactful, imaginative handling. We know that the child between 1 and 3 is vulnerable, terribly vulnerable to the attitudes of his parents. If he is regularly shamed for his accidents in the general and in the sanitary sense, he acquires a sense of shame and unworthiness. If he's excessively dominated, he becomes defiant or submissive. If he's constantly warned that the parents will no longer love him unless he behaves differently, his whole personality will be poisoned with uneasiness and antagonism. By the age of 3 or 4, the child can afford to fuss less about his independent rights and can turn more positively to people and ideas. He's enthusiastic about the people he loves, the things they do. He wants to feel like them and do things the way they do them. He's curious and intensely creative. Each new experience fires his imagination, and he must recreate the drama with himself playing a major role. His emotional closeness to people makes him not only experience their triumphs, but their injuries. This period, then, from about 3 to 6 years, is vital in setting the patterns for each child, the way in which the father and mother get along, the feelings that each parent has for the child, will leave a specific imprint on the child's ideals in such matters as what kind of a person he or she expects to be, how he or she will make out with his own sex, what he or she will be looking for in marriage, and what his or her attitudes toward their sons and daughters will be. When we add these first 3 phases of childhood together, the all-important common denominator is, of course, the parents. Truly loving parents. You know why I say truly loving. I mean not only lots of love, but the well-rounded, easygoing kind of love. In the period from about 6 to 12 years, the child is no longer satisfied with make-believe grown-up activities. It's an even greater challenge to try to act like the other boys he sees. He wants to dress like them, have his hair cut like them, use the word ain't if they do. In order to free himself to follow these new patterns, he seems to have to rebel against his parents' standards. He deliberately turns sloppy in his table manners and in his personal appearance. He says, "So what?" When he's out in the world of school or the neighborhood, he's on the lookout for opinions of other authorities to use to provoke arguments with his parents. He wants to prove them wrong, not so much for their good as for his own conviction. He and his schoolmates discuss earnestly what is proper behavior according to their own lights. Those who agree form secret clubs to convince themselves through their solidarity that they must be right and to bring group pressure to bear on the nonconformers. In other words, they're hard at work practicing social organization, the relations between the individual and the group which hold society together. As he strives to become independent of his parents' supervision, the child feels the compulsion to be more conscientious as an individual. He positively enjoys rules and turns to games that are all rules and strictness, like hopscotch and mumbly peg. His conscience is working overtime and makes him step over cracks in the sidewalk. In adolescence, the boy or girl with an almost new body and new feelings must find himself all over again. His grown-upness brings out his rivalry with his parents. One side of him aspires toward an idealized maturity. The other side, frightened by its inexperience, clings to childhood dependence. This latter side cannot admit its own timidity and loudly protests that it's the parents who will not trust him or let him grow up. Friendships and crushes have a new importance and intensity. Emotional disturbances are unfortunate enough at any stage of life. In adolescence, there is a greater likelihood that they will be acted out in delinquent behavior. This not only pushes the child outside the pale at an age when acceptance by the group is particularly vital, but often embroils him in the all too undiscriminating processes of the police, the courts, and corrective institutions. We know today that delinquent behavior is only a reflection of what the child has received from parents and society. yet we show little recognition of our responsibility in most parts of this country. It's only after truly finding himself in the earlier phases of adolescence that the youth is able to reach a more mature level in which he's capable of intimate friendship and love for others. Often it's the friendships formed in late adolescence that last most intensely through the rest of life, and this is the time when most marriages are made. We know some of the more obvious obstacles that interfere with the development of the final stages of maturity. The inability of the world to achieve peace keeps us all anxious and suspicious. In America, we have not yet succeeded in stabilizing and integrating our spiritual ideals. Our lack of set traditions has been one of the keys of our progress, but it also robs many of us of the secure enjoyment of life which stable traditions give to other societies. Some of the ideals that are constantly held up to us by advertisements, by movies, by radio, such as youthfulness, wealth, and sophistication, may not be vicious, but they're certainly not the prime parental virtues either. What are some of the more specific difficulties of parents that we see clinically? There is the anxiety which so many feel, especially when facing the care of their first child. One root of this is inexperience. In simpler societies, girls and boys are taking care of their younger brothers and sisters from early childhood right through adolescence. There's never a chance to forget how to hold a baby's head, what to feed him, how to make him behave. In conclusion, I would emphasize that though our knowledge is incomplete in most aspects of personality development, there's plenty of knowledge to do an infinitely better job than is being done today. The most obvious and immediate needs, to my mind, are to provide more and earlier help for emotionally neglected children and to improve our schools. I think the most fundamental question is, why are so many parents unable to enjoy their children? We know what some of the causes are in individuals and that individual psychotherapy can be effective in certain cases, but we have not studied the problem from a broad public health point of view, and we have not begun to think of broad solutions. One of the investigations will be to see what educational methods from nursery school through college can do to keep alive the delight in children which is usually present in childhood, and to bring the boy and girl to adulthood with the feeling that there's no more important, honorable, and soul-satisfying job than having and caring for children.
You have just heard Dr. Benjamin M. Spock, co-director of the Rochester Child Health Institute, Rochester, Minnesota, and vice chairman of the National Committee for the Mid-Century White House Conference on Children and Youth, speak to the conference on what we know today about the development of healthy personality in children and youth.